south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, here's a good question. Johnny, why aren't you on Twitter? Nope, I don't use it. Why? Because it's like hanging around in a room full of mental patients, throwing globs of at each other, trying to see how much of it'll stick. All right, today I'd like to mention some facts that just came out of an interview by a Latina journalist and political science researcher named Karina Garcia Reyes. She said she recently interviewed 33 men who worked in the drug trade. They were Mexican narcos. She was able to gain their confidence and get them to admit things about the cartel that they normally wouldn't talk about. Not to people outside the business. Anyway, she interviewed 33 cartel guys, Mexican cartel guys, and found they all shared similar stories. And one of the questions she asked them is, what is the breakdown of jobs when you work for a cartel? What's the division of labor in the narco world? She found out that with those 33 guys, 61% of them worked as dealers and money men. 27% of them were enforcers or hitmen. 6% of them were in the business of human trafficking, which is intimately connected with the narco trade. 3% of them were full-time bodyguards, and another 3% full-time drivers. So all you Plan B gringo wannabes and gonna-bes looking for job niches, I'm kidding, just thought that was interesting info. Next comes an email from Bud. He says, hey Johnny, someone said recently that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, just another government bureaucracy concerned with putting itself in the limelight, gaining more power, enhancing its budget and the number of its employees, and turning their fearless leader, Dr. Fauci, a lifelong but previously insignificant swamp creature, into an international celebrity. And now he too is addicted to the limelight. He says that should be the definition you see when you look up the CDC on Wiki. Then Bud says, who would have guessed before the virus scare the CDC would have such control over our lives and the fate of the economy, too? Meanwhile, over 18 million Americans are currently behind on their mortgage and rent payments. And that's very worrying. The temporary suspension on evictions ends December 31st. So, Johnny, what do you think is going to happen next? People with no savings will be kicked out of their houses and apartments come January 1st. That's the scare, right? But half the people aren't even taking that seriously because they think another huge bailout and another moratorium are coming. And if the bailouts don't come soon, who's got the manpower to kick people out anyway? I was a small-time landlord once too, Johnny. And if someone got a couple of months behind on their rent, you'd send them a notice and then another, and then you'd go to court and the judge would rule against them and the sheriff would come out a couple days later and evict them. The whole process taken at least 6 months from when they made their last and final payment. And that was before COVID, when the economy was kind of chugging along normally. That's how it's been for as long as I've been around, except for that 2008 mortgage crisis blip. But now you've got 10 or 20 times the number of people behind on those mortgage and rent payments. Believe me, there's not enough judges or sheriffs in the entire country to process even a fraction of those delinquents if that's what it comes to. So the bailouts will definitely come. The question is, will landlords and investors ever build new houses, malls, and business districts again? That may never happen in our lifetimes. Builders and investors are gun-shy now. And how about all those half-finished buildings in every city that just got stopped dead in their tracks when the lockdowns came? I see around my town, some contractors are back to work at these buildings, but I doubt if even a quarter of them will ever be finished. And even before the virus thing, millions of people have been living above their means and have no savings at all. At this point, if the government lets landlords and banks kick all those people out, a number of things will happen. Residential properties will completely collapse like commercial real estate's doing right now. And millions of marginal people who are living from paycheck to paycheck or stimulus to stimulus will be scrambling for somewhere to live or hunkering down in the basements of their boomer parents. That seems to be a popular solution these days. But even with bailouts, banks and landlords will go bust. There's something else that's rotten underlying this whole real estate problem. If landlords aren't getting paid There'll be millions of buildings and houses around the country suffering from deferred maintenance. If you live in a house, apartment, high-rise, and let's say the sewer or septic system backs up and you have not paid your rent since last September, if you call your landlord, he's going to laugh at you. Or maybe he'll see your caller ID and won't even pick up the phone. We've got a whole country now just filled with under-maintained buildings, ticking time bombs. And me? Well, I've jacked up my timeline on my plan B. Last year, before the shutdowns, I was rolling along on a 5-year time frame for my plan B, with the idea of taking advantage of my full pension vesting rights. But now, I'm looking at this summer to get out of Dodge. I'm cutting my losses, Johnny. I have about $120,000 in savings, and I'm willing to sell my house for what I got into it, just to break even, to get rid of it, just to clear the mortgage. I'm no longer hoping for a profit. The future's so uncertain for everyone, so the less baggage, the better. As long as the mortgage rates remain extremely low, I have a chance to sell my house, and I'm going for it. I'll even take a little bit of a loss just to get out from under it. Got my fingers crossed. Then Bud finishes off by saying, if you're having a summer 2021 seminar in Guatemala, I'll be there, Johnny. Wish me luck. Signed, Bud. P.S. My real name, my Christian name, is Carol. I know you talk about the significance of names once in a while, Johnny. I, for one, know that what your parents name you does affect your life. I know that's true because my parents made that odd choice, and I took a little bit more bullying than what's necessary. Yep, they tagged me with the name Carol. My parents said they liked that name Carol, like Carol O'Connor, the guy from that hit 60s show All in the Family. The real issue is that it's very hard to have a low profile and be anonymous when your parents have given you an unusual handle. Everybody remembers it. You can't blend in. Parents, being cutesy with kids' names does have its negative secondary effects, and I don't believe the adage that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger applies. That's a cop-out. Life is tough enough. Why give a kid extra baggage to deal with because you thought the name was cute? These days, with this transgender LGBT mania, I get some strange looks, believe me, when people see my real name when I have to use it. They think, well, you know what they think. Gender and name fluidity is all the rage now. So, in a way, I'm stuck in that fray. Luckily, I changed my name to Bud, unofficially, not legally, long before the ultra-sensitive social media and cancel culture crowd started making the rules. Well, Bud, thanks for that. And it sounds like you're feeling a little pain. You know, in my younger days, I used to think my cousin Dick had it tough. I remember things got especially harsh for the Dicks of the world when Nixon got in office. But honestly, I know parents can pick any name they want, but I think one of the worst things they could do is to pick a regular name and just switch the letters or misspell it on purpose. Like, for example, spelling Michael just slightly different so it could be mispronounced as Michelle. Or sticking a Y in a kid's name instead of the normal I, or vice versa. You know how kids are. If they can find something to pick on, they'll go for it. And if a kid isn't a little tough or have the constitution for it, I think Bud's right. That old saying, if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you stronger, is, for a lot of people, BS. Instead, it makes you more sensitive, weaker, more snowflake-like. Oh, and speaking of names, here's a little personal boots-on-the-ground story I don't think I ever told. Now, you longtime listeners might remember me saying I played in lots of bands and around the Chicago area, filling in for various groups when they needed a side man, you know. A good rock group would come into town missing a guy or two. They'd come in for a festival or a little tour or something. The group's advance man would call up the Chicago Musicians Union or someone he knew at one of the studios in Chicago and say, look, we need 2 female singers, a sax, and a bass player. For 5 gigs, 5 nights in a row at the Oldies Stage at the Chicago Blues Fest. There are tons of live music gigs in Chicago, and I got lots of work that way. Why? Because I could read music. So many guitarists and bass players just can't read music. But I could, thanks to my mother who shoved me on the cello in 4th grade. And here's how it worked. When someone comes into town, someone that's fairly famous, and he's only coming in, let's say, with his keyboardist and his arranger and his frontman, believe me, if you're a pretty well-known band but you're not superstars, sometimes you don't bring your whole entourage with you. You can't afford it. If you're not super famous, it costs way too much to put up your group in hotels and pay insurance and all that. So it's just better and infinitely cheaper to hire a few guys if you're going to be in an area for a while and doing some gigs. The headliner will bring the key components in his band, not everyone. And he'll pick up the necessary disposable members of the band when he's in town. So I did quite a few pickup gigs that way as a bass player. One time, I'll never forget this, I got the job backing up Chuck Berry on bass for a couple of gigs in Chicago. Now, he used to come in town with just him and his guitar. And his manager would call ahead to the Musicians Union or one of the studios and say, Chuck's coming in town, he needs a whole group. That'd be rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, and he'd pay $1,000 a night for 5 nights. Number one rule, you had to know every one of his songs, his catalog. But that was no biggie because every one of his songs sounds pretty much the same. And he also stipulated if the sidemen were really good, he'd duke them another $1,000 if at the end of the night he was really pleased with your work. Well, we never got the extra $1,000, but we were good enough. So then why am I bringing this up? Well, because one of the most famous rock songs in the world, one of the early classics, was called Johnny Be Good. Of course, my name's Johnny. You know the song, right? Johnny Be Good? And so when I first met him and told him I was Johnny, naturally he cracked a little smile. By the way, the deal was with Chuck Berry. He'd come in and do a gig for cash. I think it was $5,000 or $10,000 a night. I can't remember. And he'd pay the band out of his cut, that $1,000 I was talking about. So then you have to wonder, why a guy like him, so famous, so well-known in the early rock and roll world, why doesn't he have his own band? Well, that's because he got in big IRS trouble, did a couple years in jail. Plus, he did some time for an obscenity charge, too. So later in his life, he just wanted to simplify things, and he decided he's just going to take his guitar on stage and pick up a group everywhere he went. Hey, it was very cool for me. How many people can say they played with Chuck Berry, right? And along the way, you know, you get to talk to him, you do a couple gigs, do the midnight greasy spoon thing after the gigs at Denny's. Back then it was Sambo's. Anyway, about that song, Johnny Be Good, here's what he said. If you remember the part of the lyric that says, down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, back up in the woods among the evergreens, in a log cabin made of earth and wood, lived a country boy named Johnny Be Good. Okay, if you're a true rocker or a boomer, you remember that. Well, guess what? He changed those lyrics. He said originally, it wasn't lived the country boy named Johnny Be Good. It was lived a colored boy named Johnny Be Good. Well, he said one of the best career moves he ever made was on the suggestion of his management, was to change it to country boy instead of colored boy. Because you see, back then, there were separate stations, you know, white stations and colored stations. The white stations called Top 40 stations, the colored stations called R&B stations. And his management said, I think this song can cross over, but you got to change that one word. And then with any luck, the white stations will play it and it'll become a big hit. And that's exactly what happened. So remember that next time you hear the song. Originally it was, lived a colored boy named Johnny Be Good. And simply changing that one word to country, little did he know, but he was set for life. So then what's that got to do with living, playing, and or doing business in Latin America? Well, not much, but it's a story most people have never heard with some complicated and profound messages. And although Chuck Berry's dead now, you kind of have to wonder what he'd be thinking about the state of music these days, meaning rap and Cardi B's 101 ways to say ass and bitch in a 3-minute song. But I digress, man. Did I digress? Now, I know I occasionally go off point, sometimes way off point. If that rubs you the wrong way or irritates you, send me an email, theexpatfinals@gmail.com, and tell me to stick strictly to Latin America and Latin American-related topics. I'm okay with that, too. Let me know. Meanwhile, back in Latin America comes this unsettling news from Costa Rica. The title of the article, and I'll translate, Costa Rica Harley-Davidson office closes operations. It says in a nutshell, on December 17th, Harley-Davidson Costa Rica in San Jose, that has been in operation for more than 40 years, will be closing. The store, it says, formerly engaged in the marketing of motorcycles and accessories of the American brand Harley-Davidson, will cease operations. According to their internet site and Facebook page, Red Motors, as they're called, will ensure that motorcycles, Harleys that is, still under warranty will receive the necessary support. However, due to difficult circumstances in the market, service and warranty repairs will be provided that is farmed out to other motorcycle vendors. Then we have the owner of the franchise saying, this situation is out of our control. As a longtime authorized dealer, we thank the brand Harley-Davidson and our customers and business partners for many years of support. All right, there you have it. Harley-Davidson thrown in the towel in Central America after almost 50 years of its presence down here. And now, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. I definitely have an insider's view of the Harley-Davidson thing here in Latin America. You longtime listeners might remember me saying that before this show, The Expat Files Living in Latin America, I was on terrestrial radio in Latin America for quite a few years, and my sponsors were Heineken, Hooters, Harley Davidson, Gold's Gym, a couple of restaurants, and even a well-known plastic surgeon. And not only was I the spokesman for a lot of Harley Davidson weekend runs, my band played at a lot of their sponsored gigs, too. Because, you know, they'd always have some big party when the run was over. They'd meet at a bar or a Hooters or big parking lot. Well, my rock band, a party rock and blues band, was often hired to play for those events. So right now, I think, is the time to tell you a little boots-on-the-ground story of how gringos rip off gringos here in Latin America. You've heard me say this many times before, but when you're on the gringo tourist trail especially, even more so if you're a fresh green newbie gringo, you will sooner or later be marked as a newbie and ripe for the scam. And more often than not, especially if you don't speak Spanish, the guy doing the scamming will be a slick-talking or good old boy gringo. Anyway, when I first got to Latin America, the only Harley-Davidson dealership, and it's Harley-Davidson, not Davison, that existed in Central America was in Costa Rica. Yep, the one that's closing in a matter of a couple days as this show goes out on December 13th. Now, since I did once have a Harley Sportster in the United States and cracked it up, even if you crack it up like I did, you never fully lose your interest in big motorcycles, especially the cult of Harley. Now, you don't have to tell me there are better bikes than Harley. I know there are. Lots of European bikes like BMWs, Ducatis, and even American bikes like Indian. Pretty much all have outdone Harley. But Harley still has that kind of iconic cult thing going. Made in USA, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and all that. And of course, always the preference of those hard-ass biker gangs. And those iconic accessories. Man, the Harley owner wannabes down here really snapped that stuff up. So anyway, after a couple of years in Costa Rica, Harley had great success with the upscale gringo wannabe crowd. They'd buy their Harleys, park them next to their bulletproof SUVs, and only take them out once a month on a Harley run. Of course, they'd have all the accessories and the leathers. So it was young, wealthy Latins and children of the wealthy who'd buy Harleys here in Latin America, with a few hardcore expat gringos thrown in. A lot of ex-US military, too. So you have all these guys with the soft hands who never did a lick of work in their life, what you might call the cult of Harley wannabes, that would go on these monthly Harley runs. So anyway, the franchise expanded. They opened up one in Panama and in Guatemala City. Of course, for years there have been Harley dealers in Mexico. But we're talking about Harley dealerships exclusively in Central America now. And I shouldn't have to remind you that Mexico is not part of Central America. It's part of North America. So anyway, back to the story. Some years later, I end up in Guatemala working at a radio station. Actually, syndicated on something like 20 or 21 radio stations. Anyway, there was one other English gringo DJ. He was working at the station way before me. I was the afternoon drive-time gringo guy. He was the morning drive-time gringo guy. Now, he was a very bright guy, and he told me and everybody else that he had a medical degree from the U.S., but never used it. He went directly into the United States military intelligence, and he left it at that. He never told us much more, except that he wasn't in the military anymore. And, you know, we all have our own stories about why we left the States and are living in Latin America. And he had his, but he wouldn't much talk about it. And that's okay. You know, I talk about anonymity and privacy, too, so I never much bugged him about it. So anyway, one day he says, "Johnny, let's have lunch. I got to talk to you about a business deal." Turns out the entitled young kid of a Guatemalan rich guy had brought the first Harley-Davidson dealership to Guatemala City about 2 or 3 years earlier. But it wasn't doing so good because this guy was not aggressive. He was sitting on his dead ass. He had no motivation. He was just an entitled rich kid who treated the place like his toy. Then suddenly one day, Harley-Davidson pulled the franchise on him because you have to make certain sales numbers and stuff that he wasn't making. And by hook and crook, my gringo buddy found out the place was for sale, the franchise, for $150,000. By the way, when you get a Harley dealership, they front you a couple of bikes and all the merchandising. It's on consignment, but you pay interest on it. So you got to move this stuff or else you're paying month over month on stuff that's just sitting there. So my gringo buddy said, "Johnny, you want to buy into a Harley franchise?" He said he already had two expat gringos who wanted to buy in, and I knew them well. Great guys. One was a 40-something geologist oil guy. The other, you might have heard me talk about this guy before, was the head mechanic for Bell Helicopter in all of Central America. A real Harley guy himself, and man, did he know how to fix things. So we figured he'd run the repair shop, our oil guy buddy would be a silent investor, and I would be a silent investor. And my gringo radio buddy, Peter, who also had Harleys back in the States when he was younger, would quit his radio job and run the place. But I didn't invest. Why? Because he was looking for three partners, 50 grand apiece, 150 total. And he would have no skin in the game. In other words, he found the opportunity, put it all together, organized it, and would run it. He'd be a full 25% partner, but the other three guys would put in 50 G's apiece for the place, for their 25%. Now, that didn't sit right with me. I learned a long time ago and got skinned a few times from people who I got into business deals with who didn't have any dough in the game, just their expertise, if you know what I mean. So long before he pitched me that deal, I had my own deal in my mind that I would never get into business with someone who didn't have any dough in the game. So I turned him down, but I didn't tell him it was because of him. I just told him I was busy and had other things going. Well, it didn't take him long to find a third guy to put in that 50 grand, another gringo, a guy who owned one of the only expat bar and restaurants in all of Guatemala City. Like I've said many times before, Guatemala City, although it's got 2 million people, is way off the gringo tourist trail. But every city, no matter how far off the gringo tourist trail, has a gringo expat bar. That's a great niche. So anyway, they bought the franchise, got it up and running, was going for 2 or 3 years. Remember, Harley was one of my sponsors. I went to the Harley runs. I didn't have a Harley, but I used to be the MC when they had their events, and my band would play at Harley runs and parties, etc. Oh, and I have to tell you, that gringo radio buddy of mine would pester me to buy a Harley. Every week, he laid some kind of pitch on me, and I just kept telling him the same thing. I had a Harley. I like him a lot, but I've got no faith in the other guys on the road. I already had my Harley accident and cracked up my bike in the States. Don't want any more of that. So a couple of years went by. Things seemed to be going pretty well at Harley. Then I got a call out of the blue from my geologist buddy, who wanted to talk to me. He told me that he and the other partners hadn't received a dividend or any money whatsoever in 3+ years. And that when Harley Davidson came in to do an audit of the place, they do that once in a while to see how these places are going and everything's up to snuff, they discovered that basically there was some hanky-panky going on. And my radio buddy Pete was skimming big time, financing his total lifestyle off that place and juggling the books. And you got to know, the Harley Davidson branch that does the franchises has been around over 100 years, and they have tons of accounting experience, and they know hanky-panky and skimming when they see it. So after the audit, Harley pulled the franchise, and all three guys with 50 grand in the business lost their dough. Of course, they confronted Peter, but he's a very smart guy and a good talker. So he bought himself a little time, you know, to prove to them he was a decent guy and wouldn't screw them, his friends. And when they set up another powwow, he didn't show. He disappeared completely. Him and his longtime Latina girlfriend, they skipped the country. That was a while back, and still, no one knows exactly where he is. And though I'm still in contact here and there with the other investor guys, sure, they're more than sad about it. They each lost 50 grand. But they also feel some embarrassment and shame how they got taken by this guy, who really was their friend, or they wouldn't have gotten in business with him. They got gouged, but it could have been me. And you know, my oil buddy friend, he didn't get hurt a bit by it. He's got tons of dough. The investor who was the mechanic, he got hurt pretty bad because he was running the shop. And on top of it, as things collapsed on him, his Latina wife, who was a beautiful Peruvian model, he caught her cheating on him. In fact, I knew what was going on because I was in a restaurant one day and I saw her lovey-dovey with another guy while he was out of the country at some kind of Harley training seminar. And hey, you know, that's the toughest spot in the world to be in. When you see a guy's wife cheating on him, you're his buddy and he's a great guy. Well, I bit my tongue. I said nothing. But sooner or later, he did find out and he disappeared and sort of faded away too. No one knows how to get a hold of him. And the other guy who owned the Gringo Expat Bar, in that episode, he lost practically his whole nest egg, his savings. Still had the bar, but now he's taking a double whammy with this COVIDiot thing. So then you might ask, what happened to that Harley dealership? Well, a couple of Latino guys got together and bought it. And it's been plugging away ever since. If it isn't dead now, I doubt if it's going to survive with this COVIDiot thing. But I have to say, I know a couple of years back, the market was good and strong for big, hefty bikes for rich guys. Because the Indian brand bike came to Guatemala City. A franchise opened up. And if you know anything about those bikes, they're in direct competition with Harleys and more expensive and some say a lot nicer. Now, I got to think with this COVIDiot thing, the Indian franchise is dead too. So in the end, there are a few different morals that come out of that story. Number one, never get into a business with someone who doesn't have skin in the game. Two, if you get in business with one of your friends, be prepared for the fact that in the future, he just may not be your friend anymore. It's often the case that even if he's your best friend and all is well, the business thing could get in the way of that. But in regards to Harley-Davidson in general, I got to think now that they closed the flagship number one Harley-Davidson office in Costa Rica. I'm thinking the whole company's going down the tubes. Not only that, you've probably read the fact that Harley-Davidson's moving into the electric motorcycle business. Well, you know, that completely goes against the Harley grain, because one of the biggest draws and what is in fact the iconic personality of a Harley is the way it sounds and the way it vibrates when you're on it. And when you think about an electric Harley, well, electric motors, you know, are virtually silent and have no vibration at all. In fact, you've probably heard stories about people who own electric cars. They say that one of the weirdest things about owning one is that when you're at a stop sign or stoplight, there's no small, subtle movement or sound at all. Some say it's sort of eerie because, you know, with a standard internal combustion car, you always know your motor's engaged and active, even at a dead stop. So if I had to, let's say, make a prediction 5 years out, I'd say it's RIP for Harley. All right, before we close out today, I'd like to give you another household tip about living here in Latin America in an apartment or a house. There's something strange about walking into a Latino house or apartment or even high-rise that hasn't been occupied for a while. Often, when you're moving in and checking out the rooms in the house, you just might detect a bad smell, like a sewer gas smell. Might be coming from the kitchen or a certain bathroom, even the maid's quarters, especially the maid's quarters. Here's the tip. Don't call a plumber. Don't call the sewer or septic tank guy. Sure, a guy will come out and pump your tank probably the next day. Though it just might be you threw $100 down the drain because the smell will come back. So if you smell something rancid, don't call anyone yet. Not until you've poured a bucket of water in every sink and down every floor drain. Because 90% of the time, that smell is sewer gas escaping, and there's a pee trap or two under your sink or under a floor drain or two that has dried up. There's no longer water sitting in the bottom of the trap to block the gases. That's why most of the times the culprit's in the maid's quarters, because lots of gringos and expats and even Latinos don't have a maid. So the room stays empty, or it's used as a storage room, and the drains dry out because they're never used. So whether you know it or not, that pee trap, you know, that curved tubing under every sink, they're designed that way to hold an amount of water at all times to prevent gases seeping up out of the sewer, septic, or drainage system. So if a particular room in your house stinks, start pouring water down the drains. Could save yourself a lot of grief and $100.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.